Welcome to SportsWise, a podcast about sports and the law with your host, me, Gabe Feldman, director of the Tulane Sports Law Program and co-director of the Tulane Center for Sport. On this episode, I'm rejoined by sports law legend Jeffrey Kessler, co-executive chairman of Winston & Strawn and one of the world's leading antitrust and sports lawyers, and the lead lawyer in many of the athlete antitrust cases filed against the NCAA, including the Supreme Court victory in Alston and the current House v. NCAA case. Jeffrey and I talk about all of the many antitrust threats facing the NCAA, including the new suit he filed against the NCAA this week, the total amount of money damages the NCAA may face in the House case, his thoughts on NCAA President Charlie Baker's new proposal, the prospects of athletes sharing revenue with schools, the possibility of Congress stepping in to help the NCAA, the sustainability of Olympic sports, and the future of college sports. Here we go. Welcome back to the podcast, Jeffrey Kessler. Thanks for coming back on.
Thanks for having me on.
All right. A lot to cover. Let's jump right into it. Can you give us an update on the House case after the class certification decisions and just break down for the listeners where the case is, what's next, and what do you think the timeline is going forward?
Sure. The House litigation challenges the restraints on health compensation. That's names, images, and likenesses for the college athletes. We are seeking both an injunction to get rid of all the rules permanently, and we are seeking damages for a variety of different claims. Our damages are seeking payment for the fact that the basketball and football players have never been paid for giving their names, images, and likeness to broadcasts. They seek damages for being deprived of the opportunity to have video games in college basketball and football the way you had them previously when this was not an issue. People may remember that. And it also seeks damages for the fact that prior to July of 2021, the athletes couldn't do third-party deals of any type with sponsors or companies or on social media or any type of third-party endorsements. Now they can, but it seeks damages for that. We have had all those classes certified. So we have damage classes certified. We have the injunctive class certified, and we're now finishing the expert discovery on the merits. We'll then have a period of summary judgment motions, if any are filed, and we are scheduled for trial in January of 2025. This all should be wrapped up by a year from this January, which we expect all these rules will be struck down, and that we expect to obtain a very large damage recovery in the billions of dollars for the athletes.
Okay, so let's talk about the damages. The number that I've seen floated, and I think it came from your briefing, but it was $1.4 billion maybe in the ballpark for damages. Is that just a rough estimate? That's not going to be determined until you go through trial?
So that is really low and preliminary because it was based on the analysis that was done based on just the first year of data that was available at that time. We have updated our damages analysis in a report we recently filed. I cannot disclose that number because I think it's confidential, but I will just say that the damages claim that we present at trial will be significantly more than the $1.4 billion number.
Okay. And then obviously it gets trebled. So let's say ballpark, if it's twice as much, if it's $3 billion, then you're talking about $9 billion in potential damages if you win on all the claims you said you expect. Well, yeah. It was hard. So I did two things there. I doubled 1.5 and then I multiplied it by 3.
I can't disclose the number, but it will be trebled. That's correct.
But you can verify my math.
Under the antitrust laws.
Yeah.
Now, by the way, all of this could also get settled.
Right.
And that really is up to the NCAA. We have always publicly indicated that we thought it made the most sense for the NCAA to proactively get rid of these rules and come up with a new system and settle the damages claims before trial. Whether or not that will ever happen, I have no idea.
Okay, so let's talk.
That is a possibility.
Right. So let's talk about that possibility, because Charlie Baker wrote a letter earlier this week with his proposal, which has not been voted on. It's apparently coming from the NCAA itself, wasn't discussed, at least according to some of the Power Five commissioners, with the commissioners before it was released. But among other things, it would allow schools, if they decide to opt in to a different subdivision, to pay a minimum of $30,000 in a trust to, it would have to be to at least half of their athletes. Presumably that would be their football players and basketball players, and then to get the gender equity, a number of female athletes. It would also make it possible for all Division I colleges to offer students any level of enhanced educational benefits they deem appropriate. It also would allow schools to enter into NIL deals with their students, and would allow this subdivision to create whatever other rules they deem appropriate. If they agree to that eventually, right, and maybe at the January convention, who knows? But if they agree to that, is that a step towards settlement? What would you still, if that's what their new rules were, would you file a new lawsuit challenging those rules or amend your complaint to include
first
those?
Of all, I have no idea how that's all going to work out or what that means. The significance for us is that it's a wonderful admission by the president of the NCAA that these bans on paying for NIL rights directly are antitrust violations. Because since he now believes he can get rid of those bans without doing damage to college sports, which is what we've argued all along, that's going to be fatal under the rule of reason. In some ways, I view this proposal as throwing in the towel on antitrust liability, but what they've offered is not what we would settle for, right? And so it moves the ball in the right direction, but it certainly does not resolve this. The other thing I would note is his proposals also seem to go beyond NIL.
Right.
To compensating athletes more generally. And we filed, coincidentally, to this podcast, a new case yesterday called Carter versus the NCAA. And that one is going after not the NIL restraints, but the basic restraints on paying, compensating the athletes, which they referred to as pay for play. And so I think the message of all these developments is that this long battle to bring down the NCAA cartel is coming to a head. And one way or another, whether it's through us taking all these cases to trial to verdict or settling them in advance, I foresee increasingly likely a day when a fair system can be put in place for the athletes.
And so that new lawsuit, that's Dwayne Carter, Duke football player, Nia Harrison, Stanford soccer player, and Sedona Prince, who's also part of the house class, or one of the named plaintiffs in the house class. So let me stay on the settlement for a second. The Baker proposal, again, we don't know if that's going to be adopted. We don't know if it's going to be adopted in some different format, but that obviously wouldn't satisfy your damages claim, because it's only
nothing to do with that damages claim, right?
So
question in terms of going forward, okay, again, I don't really understand a lot of the details or how it would work. I can't tell you at all that it would be what we would settle for but it certainly is moving in the direction of showing a willingness to provide enhanced compensation and benefits to the athletes going forward. And that is certainly something we'd be interested in as part of a settlement. Now, having said that, this is, I understand, that is just a proposal from the president of the NCAA, which all the conference commissioners claimed they didn't even see before it was released. So I have no idea what the overall NCAA and conference positions are actually going to be about any of this. By the way, you mentioned the January meeting. I can tell you right now, nothing is going to happen on this at the January meeting. And there is no way the NCAA moves with that type of speed on anything here. I think it's just the beginning of their internal discussions, let alone any kind of settlement discussions they might have with us.
So you mean nothing's going to happen because they don't move that quickly, or nothing's going to happen because they're going to be worried to agree on anything while...
I just don't think they move that quickly. Whether they're worried to do something without settling with us or not, I have no idea. This also, they keep alluding to their desire for legislation from Congress. I do not believe Congress is going to enact any piece of legislation for them in this Congress. You know, that I don't know how that plays into their thinking or not in all of this, but I do not think, in particular, I do not see Congress granting them any type of antitrust exemption when the only thing that has caused them to move in this direction and put all these things on the table and allow third-party NIL has, in fact, been the Supreme Court's decision that said they're subject to antitrust. So I don't think Congress rushing in to grant them any type of antitrust exemption, including what I think Baker referred to as the little antitrust exemption they wanted. Yeah. I don't think that's happening.
Yeah, it's just a teensy antitrust exemption. Yeah. But here's my counter to that, just for you to consider. Senator Murphy clearly wants college athletes to be able to unionize and enter into collective bargaining. He believes that that is the way for them to best secure their rights across the board and let them handle it like every other union does. Right. But Booker and Blumenthal, at least if through their legislation, have said that an athlete bill of rights might be the better solution. That for whatever reason, that collective bargaining may not give them the same type of rights, and it may be a weak union to begin with, and there may be issues in terms of the length of their careers.
Yes.
Yeah. So if Booker and Blumenthal, who might be slowest to want to provide antitrust protection for the NCAA, but if they see the end goal is providing a minimum set of rights for college athletes, and the NCAA says, here's a proposal that will give a minimum set of rights for college athletes, and you don't have to worry about them forming a union, I could certainly see Booker and Blumenthal saying, all right, if you make those guaranteed rights high enough, then yes, we will protect you from any other additional
lawsuits. I believe that they would not protect them from antitrust laws. I don't see that happening. They may have some appetite to say that we won't allow the states to individually legislate. That's another issue that they have about this. But I don't really see them, when they recognize antitrust without unions is the only pressure the athletes have to do this. I just don't see that happening. I also don't see there being any broad enough consensus that could get actually either floor time in the Senate or, frankly, could go anywhere in the House, which can't even seem to pass the bills that they need to pass for the government to function. So the idea that somehow the NCAA is going to convince people that they are the most important thing in the world to grant this legislation to, not so much.
Yeah, I it's hard to disagree with that. It's hard to disagree with the general dysfunction of Congress. I would only say a possible distinction here is that I don't know that there is any more unifying force anymore in this country than sports, and college sports in particular, and that the legislators from Alabama, when Nick Saban says he needs help, they often listen. And even our Supreme Court. Nothing brought our Supreme Court together for a 9-0 opinion like college sports. Now, they were against the NCAA there in the Alston case, but it still has managed to align groups. But I take your point that if you're betting on Congress doing anything, you're probably going to lose that bet.
Is that I think the one thing that might help them with Congress in the future is reaching an antitrust settlement with us.
Yeah. Yeah.
Because if the antitrust claims are resolved and approved by the court as fair and reasonable to the classes, both the past damages and the going forward, then it's much easier for Congress to think about the rest of it.
Right. Right. And that's why, to me, the Baker proposal, if you're thinking about a multi-step process to get a settlement, and a settlement's difficult with all the different lawsuits out there and the employment cases, but if it's, we will provide a better system going forward, that's more fair. And you may disagree with, say, we need more detail before we'd ever agree to that, but also is damages for the last 6 years or whatever the number is. And then if you package that together as a global settlement to bring to Congress to say, we now as the plaintiffs are on board with this, then you start to see a path to say, we're not going to be in this sort of limbo where we're going to get sued constantly.
Yeah, I think if they settled with us, that would be a great step for them, for the athletes, for everyone else going forward in all different ways. They obviously now have a new state to deal with, that the new case to deal with that the attorney generals have brought over the transfer portal rules, which is not the subject of any of our litigation, which they have to figure out as well. And of course, they have this other litigation over whether or not they are employees for the Fair Labor Standards Act, which is a whole separate issue, really has nothing to do with all litigation. So they've got a lot of fires to try to put out.
Yeah, and the NLRB and your case seeking back pay for the Alston payments and other lawsuits that are out there. So there's no shortage. Let me ask you one more question.
By the way, we have nobody to blame but themselves, right? This all came about because they have stubbornly defended this cartel for 80 years, right? And long past its expiration date in terms of what this became in terms of huge businesses.
Well, it's ironic because you know who they do blame is you, but you're right. But just like the NFL, and because you're the target as the player advocate and representative. But let me go back for 1 second to the damages and TV rights and revenue sharing from TV deals. Are you seeing that? And I know how this is discussed in the House case, but do you see that as an NIL issue or separately as a revenue sharing for a pay for play compensation issue or both?
So there are two different things. NIL, we have used a percentage of the broadcast agreements as a way to value what NIL would be worth and would be paid in a competitive market. So we've used that as a basis. We're not seeking to compel revenue sharing from there. We're saying, this is how you base your damages calculation. And that's what the judge is permitted to go forward with. And going forward, if we win, they would be free to pay for NIL rights or broadcast, which we think they're going to pay for out of their broadcast agreements, but it doesn't require, they can pay for it out of any pocket they want. But that's the most logical pocket, because what happens is the TV networks and the Amazons and the others require that the NIL rights be provided in exchange for those payments. So it's logical it would come out of that money. With respect to the new case challenging the pay-for-play rules, again, it's not compelling a sharing of broadcast, but it's saying get rid of the rules so they can be compensated. And of course, an economist would tell you they will be compensated based on the values they generate. So they generate values in broadcasting. They generate values in ticket revenues. They generate values in sponsorship. They actually generate values in alumni contributions and elsewhere. Somehow, all those values will yield to a competitive market price, right? And so in that sense, you could say those revenues are going to be shared, but those revenues are really just a source of the value they're generating, which will yield damages to the athletes. And by the way, some of that value is realized by through athletic scholarships. We acknowledge that, right? It's just not remotely what the competitive market value would be, right? So when you look at what this would be, it's the competitive market value. You would credit the fact that they're already giving athletic scholarships. Now, what's the difference?
Right. Now, on that general note, I think it's clear that if the NCAA just eliminated all of its restrictions on athlete compensation and mobility, not that the transfer portal is part of your case, but assuming they just removed any interference with competition for the athletes, and so you had a complete free market, that would satisfy your interest and your complaint in both the House case and now the Carter case.
If they would get rid of all restraints, we could obviously make a deal about that.
Right.
I suspect that if this is settlement, they're going to want something more complicated than that.
Right. Right. So
ridding a lot of the restraints. But for example, we do not challenge and would not challenge their academic eligibility requirements.
And why not? Why not? Why wouldn't you challenge them?
Because we view those as actually having a pro competitive value in requiring that the athletes be students. And when there is value in them, we've been consistent. We took the same position in the Alston litigation.
But why is that a pro-competitive value? Why not just let the schools decide whether they want to have
consumer interest? We have always acknowledged that the reason college sports is different from pro sports, it has a separate consumer interest, is not because the athletes can't be paid. That's the false dichotomy. No one cares about that at the consumer level. It's because they're students and they're making progress towards their degrees at the university, right? And so we've never objected to those requirements.
But I get it, you haven't. But let's say we're in a system where a football player is deemed ineligible because they didn't maintain a particular GPA. Mm. And what's to stop, whether it's you or the next plaintiff's lawyer, from saying nobody cares if that athlete
I think that case would be defeated under the reverse quick look that the Supreme Court alluded to, that is so clearly not going to be viewed as a rule of reason violation that it would survive. Yes, you could file a lawsuit to challenge anything, but I don't think a case challenging academic eligibility would have much of a chance under, as I view, the rule of reason and what I think the Supreme Court would do and what the lower courts would do.
Yeah, I just wonder if you have an economist who comes in and says there's no indication that this is demand enhancing.
I just don't think.
I've
spent a long time studying these markets.
Yeah.
That, I think, is the one thing that's always been true, that there is a distinction of college sports in that they are students.
I agree.
I just don't think that would be susceptible.
Yeah. I agree. And I've argued to the NCAA that they should get ahead of this and only enforce the rules that are reasonably necessary to maintain
the distinction between college and pro. We had a settlement with them. We'd have no problem saying this settlement permits the eligibility rules, right? Because we don't view them as violations.
So what about the other rules, though, that are not as I think maybe clearly on the academic pro-competitive benefit side of the line? So if the NCAA said, we're going to allow NIL, but there are going to be what they call guardrails in place to ensure that this is a legitimate NIL deal for work performed at some reasonable value, that it's not a cover for
Now you're taking me too much into the details of what we would settle for, so I'm not going to go there.
Okay, fair enough. All right, so let me go to my next question. I think it's safe to say that you don't believe at this point, and you don't think the courts believe, that amateurism is a valid defense. And although the NCAA continues to press the argument, in your latest complaint, you wrote, and the plaintiffs wrote, that any continued claim by the NCAA and the conferences that amateurism is a pro-competitive justification is now factually bankrupt. So what is left for the NCAA in your mind to argue as a pro-competitive benefit? Or is it just, as we talked about, their ability to maintain their athletes as students, and so to differentiate college sports as students versus pro sports as non-students?
I frankly don't think they have anything left in their quiver that the courts are going to accept. If you read through our new Carter complaint, you'll see we identified what we think are their remaining claims that they make for justification, and we don't think any of them are going to withstand. Right. I frankly expect that we will win the Carter case on summary judgment, because I don't think any of them are going to have a basis to go forward anymore. And I think, by the way, they know that, which is why you see Baker making the proposals he's making now.
Yeah. Okay. So let me ask two and a half quick questions. First one is the argument that you don't believe is a valid argument, but that restricting athlete compensation enables broad-based athletic opportunities, enables Olympic sports to thrive, allows schools to offer more sports, you know, put aside Title IX for a second, but allows women's sports to be more vibrant. That if let's just assume this is true, that if you win your cases and the schools spend more money on their football and basketball teams than they already are, and so they keep paying the coaches a lot, but they also pay the athletes a lot, and so schools decide that they are going to cut sports, and that they do lose opportunities, and Olympic sports do suffer. Is your answer to that, that's not antitrust law's concern? If Congress wants to come in and do something to protect, then they can protect. But if the market is saying we don't value Olympic sports as much, then antitrust law can't do anything about it?
First of all, let me be clear. Don't tell me to assume it. Factually, that would never happen. I just want to be clear. They have claimed that would happen when cost of attendance was allowed. They have claimed that would happen when NIL payments were allowed. They have claimed that would happen when educational benefits were allowed with Alston. They always claimed that could happen, and it never happened. And then how do I know it will ever happen? There's something called Division III. Division III has no revenue supports to support it, but guess what? They do all those other sports too. The schools are able to sponsor that they don't even, the tiny fraction of money that they use to support those other sports is less than the increase they're going to get from the college football playoff money under their next contract. So this is a ridiculous argument. Having said that, the ridiculous argument is also not an antitrust defense. And the reason is there's something economists call allocative efficiency. Their argument is that a competitive market would allocate money in a way which we don't like. Okay, that is not a pro-competitive justification. Right. That is a justification that competition is bad. Congress has said competition is good. It's like going in and arguing that it would be okay for the movie studios to decide, we don't want to pay more money to the star actors anymore. That's the allocative efficiency. We don't want to do that because we think we really should pay more money, be in the public interest, to pay for art films that we think is a good thing, but like the market's not supporting. That may be a good thing or a bad thing, and people could say, let's do that. But the antitrust laws don't do that. They don't give you the ability to say, let's reallocate money for what competition would allow in terms of that. Having said that, there's plenty of money to spend to support all those sports. If Alabama wants to support all of its other sports, just don't pay the strength and conditioning coaches $750,000 a year. Pay them $500,000 a year and support your rowing team. It's ridiculous argument for those schools.
And then if they are, if their argument, though, is that if they keep spending more money on athletics, it's going to hurt the academics and it's going to minimize the educational role in athletics because competition is just going to force them to keep spending more and more and more. What about that? Is the harm that it might cause to academics, is that no, you're saying no.
So again, competition is already requiring them to spend whatever they're going to spend. The difference is how you allocate it. Right now, they're prohibited from allocating it to the athletes. So it goes to the coaches, the athletic directors to build gigantic facilities, to the conference commissioners, to all sorts of people except the athletes. Whatever diversion that is taking from their educational mission is there right now and will continue to grow. What our lawsuits will do is allow competition to allocate it to the people who generate that money, which are the athletes, as opposed to the people like the athletic directors who virtually have no role in generating that money.
So let me ask, so then what if they decided to restrict spending across the board? What if they said, we are taking this seriously, we're going to rein in coaching salaries, we're going to rein in spending on facilities because we want to support our academic mission better than we're already doing. So athletes, well, are included in that.
They couldn't do that either under the antitrust laws.
Well, because of the law case, but
there's a case on that. It says the way to spend less on that is let you spend it on the athletes. Naturally, what the economists would say is that if you could spend it on the athletes, you're not going to divert it to all these inefficient uses.
Right. Okay. Two last quick questions. One, some of your biggest legal victories in the sports context have been advising NFL players and other professional athletes to dissolve their union to take advantage of antitrust law because they have to choose, according to the courts, either antitrust law or labor law. They can't have them both at the same time. Right now, college athletes have antitrust law. They don't have a collective bargaining right. They may get it. If you're advising the athletes, do you advise them not to form a union and continue to bring these antitrust claims? Because in the NFL players' context, you told them to break up the union so they could bring the antitrust claim. Now they have the antitrust claim. What would your advice be, to continue down the antitrust path or take the labor path?
Right now, the antitrust path is the only viable path because there was an effort to unionize in Northwestern, and the NLRB rejected that, not because the athletes didn't vote for it, but because most of the big schools with the big revenues are state-owned. And you can't unionize them under state law unless Congress changes that. Now, they're making an effort now, there's an NLRB complaint, to argue that maybe you could unionize them at the conference level, right, because the conferences are not state-owned there. But until that all gets straightened out and either Congress passes a law that overrides the state laws so that you can unionize the state institutions, or the NLRB decides after going through the courts and maybe going up to the Supreme Court that you could unionize at the conference level. Until that's resolved, there is no union there that's viable. So antitrust is the ticket. And I believe we will win these cases or settle these cases, one or the other, says probably before any of those collective bargaining issues are resolved.
Right. At least before the resolve, finally, because it may be the Dartmouth decision could come down any day.
Yeah, but that would take years to make its way through a variety of other places.
Right. But it's interesting because a lot of people in the NCAA or athletic directors I've talked to have now said maybe collective bargaining is the best option for us. So they may voluntarily recognize the athletes as employees. So they may not have to wait.
I don't think the state schools are allowed to do it.
But if they're joint employers, if it's them.
Again, I don't know how that would work out. And that's why the Dartmouth case is interesting, but Dartmouth is a private school, right? So even if you unionize Dartmouth, that's what was held, it won't resolve whether you could, and Dartmouth is a low revenue school in sports. Right. It won't resolve the real big issue, because the biggest issue for the athletes is where the money is, right? And the monies are in the P5 conference schools. May soon be P4, but to those schools, wherever they end up residing, that's where the big dollars are.
Yeah. Okay, last question, quick one. Pro athletes, women's soccer players, college athletes, who's next for you? Who are you going to represent next? Who should wake up or think about being scared that Jeffrey Kessler is coming for them next?
Oh, everybody.
Okay. Everybody, you're on notice. Jeffrey Kessler is coming for you. Thank you, Jeffrey. I appreciate the time as always. Love to have you back on as these cases develop further, but good luck. Be well. Happy New Year.
Thank you. Happy New Year to you and to all the listeners.
Thanks, Jeffrey. Really appreciate it. And thank you as always to my loyal sponsor, the Tulane Center for Sport. And thank you for listening. If you're trying to figure out the perfect gift for your loved one, please consider giving this podcast a 5-star review and downloading and subscribing to it. What better way to say I care? See you next time on SportsWise.